You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Millennial Money. Today we've got a lot of things to talk about. We're going to start by talking about stocks and what the heck happened in the market yesterday. Then we'll talk a little bit about a lawsuit, and of course we'll talk about Bitcoin under 30,000. A lot to cover, but folks, I want to start with you. Jeremy, why don't you start us off? What the heck happened on Monday? And then I want to know what Andre and Graham did about it.
Really quick, before Jeremy talks about what happened on Monday, we got to talk about what happened on Monday. And it's down below in the description because we got a Millennial Money Clips channel. This is the first time ever that we've mentioned it in the first minute. Guys, go and subscribe to that Millennial Money Clips channel. I think we're almost at 20,000 subscribers right now.
Yes. You'll find the link right under the link to Webull where you could get two free stocks as long as you deposit $100.
Wow. Holy smokers, that ain't no jokers. Oh my gosh. Woo. Okay, guys. So yeah, man, it was ugly. Yesterday was ugly in the market. I'll tell you that. Dow was down about 1,000 points roughly at the lows. We had Russell continuing to sell off yesterday. And it's amazing because the small cap stocks have been selling off. You know, no one's really noticed it except for maybe us and a lot of our subscribers that are maybe in some of the smaller stocks, some of the high growth names, right? But I feel like Wall Street as a whole hasn't noticed this big sell-off because Wall Street's really caught up into the big companies, big tech. Those stocks have been pumping, man. Apple, Google, Microsoft, a lot of those stocks, Amazon, are near 52-week highs. But meanwhile, everything else has been selling off. It sells off again yesterday. I did some buying yesterday, I'll be honest, and I did switch out a position. I did sell some Shopify stock, which has been, yeah, it's been, I love Shopify, but that stock had been pumping heavy, and I'm seeing a lot of these other deals out there. A lot of stocks I'm looking at are down 50, 60, 70%, 52-week highs.
And, what are you buying, Wynn?
I've been buying some Wynn options, but I'm really trying to wait for the 2024s to come out in less than 2 months. Bought some Corsair because Corsair yesterday was at 28 and change.
Yeah.
So some Corsair, some Voyager Digital and at like $10.
Oh my God. At $10. Yes. What's up with that, man?
Oh. Yeah. It's just following crypto, man. So that's what's going on there. But yeah. What about you guys? You making any moves yesterday specifically with that big sell-off?
Yeah. Bought some Rocket. It dropped below $17 briefly. And I was like, how could this not? I mean, it's I don't know why it's been selling off. Maybe, Kevin, maybe you know more than I do. I'm looking at this thing and there's no reason today should be down like 6% or whatever it was. So I bought some Rocket. I bought Ally. I think that dropped like $46 at the low. I'm like, again, I think before 50 bucks, it seems good. And then obviously more S&P. And started buying a little bit more Bitcoin to start.
Yeah, I think on Rocket, one of the reasons we're seeing that sort of trend down is because you're kind of in this weird position where if there's no inflation, then or low inflation, then rates stay low, and it's kind of like, okay, people have already refinanced. You know, if rates go up, then maybe there's more spread and more profit to be had, but then less people are buying, so you lose the buyer. So it's kind of like, no matter which way, people, right now with how uncertain the rate market is, I feel like the ones bearing the brunt of it are Rocket Mortgage and United Wholesale Mortgage Company. I think both of them are phenomenal companies. It's just the market is just not showing them any love right now.
Right. It's so crazy that the market dips 2% and people freak out. It's like
oh, you're one of those commenters.
Oh, no. Here's the thing, though. It's not just 2%, though.
Every single day, and it's like, oh, wake me up when it gets fun. But no, I just I just bought index funds. I didn't buy anything specific other than, you guys are going to kind of hate me for this, I applied for a loan on a car. So I'm getting a car.
You are
a Tesla. That's the only loan you could apply for.
Yeah, that's what I did.
You did.
I did,
man.
Yeah,
good fun.
A Model Y, a long range Model Y. Yeah, they actually. So Tesla offered me 2.5%, which is their base rate. So I go on Reddit and I'm like, "Is this really the best rate?" And people are like, "No, just email their team." And people are getting it dropped to like 1.8, but this was like 4 to 6 months ago, when it wasn't as crazy. So Tesla raised its floor to 2.5%. And they were like, if you can beat us, then, you know, by all means, go with them. I asked, I kid you not, like every bank under the sun, what their best rate was. And their best rates for like Chase, for example, their auto loans are 3.5%. So I applied with a credit union, which I won't mention just because I'm not promoting them, but a credit union, and they gave me 1.9%, which is pretty great. So I went with them.
Oh, yes. I actually support what you're doing. First of all, I think it's very smart that you're getting the Y and you're not like blowing it on an S, because it's so easy to like, oh, I want to have the latest and greatest, the Plaid or whatever. That's a lot of money. I mean, you could buy like four Ys.
Right.
So I think that's great. You're getting like the same tech and the same everything, right? I'm all for that. And I'm all for you doing the loan, man. I still have a loan on my Model X that I got in 2017. I got 1.49% in 2017, and I still have it.
That's amazing. Yeah. I wish the rates were that good now. Why do you guys think they raised the base rate to 2.5 now? Is that because of the shortage, or just it's just selling like hotcakes even with 2.5?
I think hotcakes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think Tesla knows that they're competitive, and I think if people were going elsewhere, Tesla would lower the rates to be more competitive. But when they're the lowest and they're selling their own product, it makes sense.
Mm. Yeah. And Andre, you brought up a really good point there. And to a lot of folks watching this who haven't really built up your credit score, and I don't know how much we actually talk about this on any of our channels, to be honest, but I remember when I had almost a very lack of a credit score, let's put it that way. You know, I got kind of, you know, a really bad rate from a bank. And then I was told you need to go to a credit union and actually go ahead and, you know, open up an account with them. And likely you're going to be able to get a much lower rate in a very quick amount of time than going through the actual corporate banking system. And they were 100% right. I think I got a 2% or 2 percentage points or 3 percentage points lower of a loan with the credit union that I'd set up an account with versus what banks were trying to give me at that time.
Yeah, it's incredible how much better credit unions are for loans. That like you will not get a better rate from anywhere other than the credit union. It's incredible.
Yeah. And what's crazy too.
Okay, Graham.
What's crazy too, that they don't tell you this, but for auto loans, apparently if you ever want to get a really expensive loan, like let's say Andre, one day you're like, I want to go and buy that Lamborghini and I want to get a loan on that Lamborghini. Almost no bank, believe it or not, even with your income on it, even if you're making $1 million, $2 million a year, banks will hesitate lending you money on a Lamborghini if that is your first auto loan in that category. It's so weird. They want to see you have a history with paying off specifically auto loans. And it was someone else I was talking to about this, because I've never applied for like a high-end like car loan like that. But they say even with a good credit score and a mortgage and high income, they want to see that you've had a history building up to those cars. And I had the same issue with the Ford GT insurance. No one wanted to insure me on the Ford GT because I had zero history with insuring an expensive car like that. Believe it or not, it's wild. There's too high of a risk. So you have to start off with an insurance company to pay like some ridiculous rate up front, kind of get that out of the way, be insured, and then other insurance companies will accept you.
How did you get around that?
I found one insurance broker who actually agreed to insure me on this car. I kid you not, there, I probably got three different quotes. They all wanted $4,000 to $5,000 a year for me to drive 1,500 miles.
In oh my whole gosh. Vehicle,
because I had no experience operating a vehicle like this. So
now you're accruing experience with the car sitting in your garage.
Basically, but I found one insurance company who insured me $1,500 a year.
That's incredible. 1,000
miles a year with a stated value of the car, which is something that's really important.
You also got a loan, or did you pay it in cash?
I paid for it in cash. It wasn't worth it to go and try shopping for a loan. I wasn't going to do that. But I could always get a loan. It's probably smarter for me to have gotten a loan on that, just to show that I have a loan, even if you paid off after a few months. So
I don't know if you guys would like burn me if I said that I bought a $300,000 cash car. Like you guys would just probably. Like destroy me. You'd be like, oh, this whole video is going to be about
this. Andre, Model Y is not an investment. This car, believe it or not, has gone up in value. So I bought a 306.
Oh,
now, these cars are selling for like $375,000, and there was a recent one that sold at auction for $400,000. It had 1,500 fewer miles than mine did.
I don't know. It just seems like such a terrifying investment, though, because it's not like a stock or real estate. I mean, you could take it out one time and it's mm-hmm. wrecked and it's destroyed, and there goes your $300,000.
No, that's why you have insurance.
Well,
wait a minute.
I think we'll have to pick that conversation up elsewhere.
we got to wait till the end of the video to own each other.
Yeah. I want to go back, if y'all don't mind, to something Andre said. Andre mentioned, hey, the S&P was just, or Dow or whatever, was just down 2% yesterday. Why is it such a big deal? I think there are two reasons. One, 88% of stocks yesterday closed red. That's like everything. I mean, we didn't get to a 90% day, but that's a lot of red. And then of that, a lot of the higher risk stuff, like whether it was actually it was a little bit of everything. It was yesterday was so weird. It was tech, SPACs, like higher value tech and SPACs selling off like crazy. But also all the recovery stuff, Cheesecake, the airlines, Nordstrom's, Wynn. It got wrecked yesterday. I mean, it's all back today, which is just like showing the bipolarness of the market. But I want to know about you guys. How are you handling this crazy bipolarness of the market?
I thought you were going to say, this is an inflection point. This is a series where the market's going to go down. I don't know.
I will interrupt and just say quickly, I yesterday, while I was watching the market do its thing or doing my live streams, I was thinking to myself, it's too soon to tell on just one of these panicky days if it's actually like a switch, right? So I spent most of yesterday thinking to myself, let's see what happens tomorrow. Because I thought there was a good chance we might get like a middle of May, where you saw two or three or four just bloody red days in a row, where this was just going to be a bloody week. So I spent a lot of time sitting on the sidelines watching yesterday, which things weren't cheap for me, at least. I wasn't seeing major deals to where I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to buy. So I was willing to be patient. But boy, I have to say, I'm very shocked that it rotated back this quickly.
You know, I think it'd be a fun exercise if we, I guess, pretended for a moment that we did get a COVID variant, because I think I could speak for everyone. Like, I wish we could go back in time and know what would happen with COVID, how long it lasted, how much prices dipped, how much we recovered. And if that happens again, would we be able to capitalize on what we know from the previous one, or would it happen in a different way this time?
It happened in a different way, because now you have companies that took on a lot of debt. And a lot of money already injected into the economy, and you have to do that again. I mean, everything at this point is unprecedented, so there'd be no way to predict, I don't think.
Hey,
Jeremy?
Yeah, well, I actually want to come back to this, because I think this is an interesting argument, but I want to push back on you, Mr. Kevin, for a minute here, Mr. Meat Kevin, okay? What are you saying? Dang it, he's gone. Okay, let's just go on. So, Kevin, wait a minute here. Okay, a lot of stocks down 40, 50, 60 plus percent from 52-week highs. I don't understand this concept of there's no good deals, there's no deals. I understand if we're talking big tech. Yeah, those stocks have pumped and they've just continued to roar higher and roar higher. But I mean, I can understand if maybe you're like, well, I don't want to buy more Tesla because Tesla is not down that much. But a lot of these stocks, man, you're down 50, 60, 70%. So you're telling me you can't find any deals in some of these more spec stocks, a little risky?
Yeah. I mean, look, if you look at, like, for example, Peloton, right? The thing ran up to 190 on a Motley Fool pump. It was like, this was, we're talking like the peaks you're referring to, in my opinion, some of these are just like euphoric peaks. And I think maybe more rather than Peloton, or even like you could even look at a C3 AI, euphoric post-IPO peak, Affirm, the lending company, euphoric post-listing peak. But I think maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think more broadly, maybe you're referring to the recovery stock sector. I'm concerned about the recovery stocks. I do think that, I mean, you know, whether it's Nordstrom or Wynn or whatever, I do think that some of these, let's see, Nordstrom was 46 at 33 now. I mean, it's not quite 50% of those. So maybe you'll have to let me know which ones you're referring to. But some of these, I'm still concerned that they ran up way too much on vaccine hopium, that the valuations are just way too high for the amount of debt they have. Sure, their earnings are going to be great. But you know what I'm really going to be looking for in these earnings reports going forward is I want to hear if these CEOs say, look, we got crazy demand, but crap, we don't have the employees to service all the customers. So we're actually, are we losing money? Is margin going up? Is margin going down? I want to see what happens in these earnings. So I'm not excited about jumping in before these earnings, because I think we're going into these earnings with a lot of hope and not a lot of fact.
Yeah, you brought up some of the travel stocks. Some of the others that were coming to my mind was something like Voyager Digital that topped out about 30, right? And that's down to 10, 11. Is that not worth a little risk reward there? Corsair Gaming topped out 51. It was 28 yesterday. You know, that's not 50%, but, you know, down quite a bit. And then obviously a lot of the travel stocks are still significantly off of, you know, where some of them had moved to. And there's some others, but that was just kind of like a general thing, because to bring it back to Andre's point, Andre, you were saying, like, you know, what's the big deal? S&P fell, but there's a lot of people that are in some of those stocks that have been feeling the pain. And so it's kind of like, if in the crypto market, usually, you know, all the other cryptos kind of follow Bitcoin, right? If Bitcoin's moving up huge, all the other cryptos follow, or if Bitcoin's going down, they all get killed, right? This would be a situation like Bitcoin and Ethereum are doing great and every other crypto is getting destroyed. And so everybody's like, you know, there's a lot of people feeling pain, and that's kind of the stock market right now. If you're in Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon, you haven't felt
it. Not feeling it.
But if you're in some of these other plays, you're down 20, 30, 40, 50 plus percent from highs that were reached just a couple months ago.
Right.
So, yeah. Look, I where I will agree with you is actually in something like a Voyager. So I personally think this Bitcoin sell-off is not only a really good test for crypto, but absolutely, it's the entire sector is getting dragged down. So whether it's big digital assets, this thing was like a $4 stock. It's down at like 70 cents right now or whatever, you know, or Voyager Digital at 10 bucks. You know, is it going to go back to six? I don't know. Right. But the amount of volatility, or even Coinbase, the amount of volatility in these crypto stocks, oh, insane. There might be opportunities there, but then you also beg the question of, like, or should I just buy some of the coins, right? So there's a little bit, like, the crypto space is, I don't know, I want to hear from Andre on the crypto argument. As far as Corsair, yeah, you're right. I mean, I guess what I would look at for Corsair is, why did it run up when it did as much as it did? It was there, or did it become, because there was a moment, I think, and I could be wrong, but I think for a moment, the thing became a momentum play.
It did.
Okay. So if it did, then I wouldn't want to use that measure. I'm willing to use a different high, as long as just not a momentum peak.
Yeah. So BlockFi was offering their private equity deals, right, to their strategic partners, their social media influencers. And I've been going back and forth on that thing for so long. And I feel like the reason I can't decide is because I'm so heavily invested in crypto already that I feel like with all of these crypto stocks, they're nothing more than just a proxy for Bitcoin. Like, literally everything is connected to Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like 90%, 95% of their performances are so heavily tied to it. So I'm just like, I don't feel like I'm diversifying. I just feel like I'm getting the same exposure from three different entrances. And so instead of doing that, I'm just like, you know what, I would just rather dollar cost average into Bitcoin for now and not get into like risky private equity deals or even crypto companies like Voyager or even more Coinbase. I feel like I've got enough of that stuff. And with crypto, did you guys see Jerome Powell's semi-annual report? So he was basically talking about regulating stable coins. So he says in September is when we'll have a lot more clarity as far as what they're going to do. But we're not sure if Congress is going to introduce their own stable coin or if they're going to regulate what's currently out there on the market. But like, can you imagine if the government came out in September and they were like, by the way, all the stable coins that are currently in the market, yeah, they're not really valid. Like, what would happen to their value? And even if nothing changes, let's just say they have no influence over it. How much fear would the market have in thinking about it that way?
Like, how would they regulate it?
Why would they regulate it?
How?
Oh, how? Would they regulate it? Well, I don't know exactly how they're going to regulate it, but I mean, that's the problem. It's like nobody knows what they're going to do.
Feel like if they could regulate that, they would regulate the entire crypto market.
Well, that's the goal.
Stop there.
Stable coins, how much of crypto's value is derived from stable coins? I'd say it's more than 50% at this point.
Well, then if that's the case,
from the pumps of, you know, yeah. USDC, GUSD, like how much of their value is derived from those stable coins?
Well, then I think the bigger issue isn't so much regulation. It's Tether. It's the whole Tether thing that it's investigation into that. I think that could be a worse thing than the government coming in and saying, oh, well, don't do stable coins. I mean, that's probably what they could do, right? Or at least look into the metrics of Tether.
Their fear is not Tether. Their fear is the banking system getting a hold of these stable coins. I think it was reported something like 85%, I believe, of central banks are considering issuing their own stable coins in their own native currency. And so if banks start using these stable coins, which are completely unregulated, can you imagine the amount of like sorcery that would be going on in the shadow banking system as far as like the leverage, the loans, and the government can't follow that. They can't see that. There's no way to regulate that. And so they're like, hold on, before this gets way out of hand and we're recreating 2008 and something we can't even control, we need to regulate this stuff, and which makes perfect sense. And I think that's the fear is like, I don't know what they're going to do. Are they going to replace it? Are they going to supplement it? Are they like, no one knows.
I will give my opinion on it. My belief is that at some point in the future, the Federal Reserve will probably be the first to move on this. At some point in the future, I think they'll move before Congress, because quite frankly, I don't think Congress understands anything about this. Unless there's some crash, you know, then something will happen faster. But barring some kind of disaster with stablecoins, my expectation is we'll just have a U.S. stablecoin, you know, central bank digital currency, and it'll just be something that's designed to accommodate faster transactions, especially for like cross-border transfers of U.S. dollar or something like that. Something where they look at it, go, this is more efficient, this is more transparent, it's safer, there's less fraud, it's faster than wires. But until they can prove that it's better, faster, safer, more efficient, transparent, whatever, than wire transfers, I don't know. I think it's going to probably be a few years.
I don't know. So September, I guess we'll see. But I mean, Jerome Powell said that like, we don't really need stable coins. If the government comes out with their own, there's no need for all these other ones. So I don't know what that means.
You mean if the government comes out with their own, you think that might create the end of other stable coins?
Possibly. I'm not saying it will.
I think that's a good thing. If they're able to create a better product that people like and use, I think that's a good thing, wouldn't it? If they have the trust and the regulation, you know what you're getting. You're not buying into something like maybe Tether, where you know it's not so quite obvious.
I think long term you're right, but short term I think that's going to decimate the market. Like people are going to be so afraid. I think it's going to
People have to use it though.
I want to chime in here and just mention that if all we needed was one stable coin, then why do we have so many stable coins right now? I don't think the issue is a matter of having just one stable coin. I think the issue is having a stable coin that you trust versus one that you trust less but are willing to accept a risk-reward benefit for. So, for example, why can you get 7 or 8% on USDC or whatever at some of these companies, and they're paying you interest on stable coin, which we don't know how many times has been lent out. We don't know how many times it's been collateralized, right? So you have this darkness, this shadow that's kind of like, yeah, here, hold my promise of a dollar. But yeah, if you want to earn 8%, then you don't really have that promise of a dollar anymore. It could be lent out many different times. I think really what you're doing then is you have this marketplace of stable coins where you go, okay, I know my stable coin at the USDC or like the it wouldn't be called USDC, but whatever the Fed coin is, I know that's always going to be worth at least a dollar. And I bet you the interest rate on it is going to be a big fat zero.
Well, I think
you can have the Fed coin with zero interest. And then right next to it, it's here's the USDC paying you 8%. Both are promising you a dollar. One is actually backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, and you're actually going to get your dollar. The other is like, maybe you'll get your dollar, but you'll get some interest in the meantime.
Right. I think that's a really great framework to work around, but I think that's presuming that that's how the Fed thinks about it. They might be thinking about it a whole completely different way. Like, we really need to shut this down. We don't want our, you know, like if the Federal Reserve is Papa Bank, then all these other central banks are like the kids, right? And the stable coins are the matches. And it's like, we don't want these kids getting their hands on their matches. So let's just get rid of these matches and just use our own tool. So they might be going about it like that. We don't know. But I think you're right. As far as framework goes, that's how you'd think about it. But I do think that before the government creates their stable coins, I think we'll see privatized stable coins. I think maybe Diem from Facebook will probably see before the Federal Reserve stable coin.
I think the Fed will be very slow. Graham, what do you think about this? You're kind of quiet.
I just don't see how they could regulate it, to be honest with you. I think besides just like saying they're going to ban it, I think if they were going to regulate it, they would go for the entire cryptocurrency market. I think realistically, what's probably going to happen is they create their own stable coin that they want to make so good that people prefer to use that over anything else. I think that's what makes the most sense. Then they're doing a service. They get people comfortable with like kind of trusting the government with cryptocurrency. Perhaps it's better. People prefer it than just holding cash in a bank account. At least they have a stable coin. Maybe they're able to transfer it from one person to another a lot faster without wire fees. I just think if they just make a better product, people would use it.
I don't know. I think a lot of people, especially in the crypto space, are kind of, you know, I guess anarchists is the right word for it. And they're the last people to be like, yes, I'm going to use this.
Well, not only that, but also those folks believing that the Fed is going to create a better product than the free market.
Right.
I don't know, Graham.
All right. Okay. Listen, you win that one. But that doesn't mean they can't try. They could try. That's what I think. I can't see them saying, all right, we're banning stable coins. Right. How would they even begin to do that and then actually enforce it? And then if you break that, how are they going to prosecute you? Going through the courts for like, oh, he had a stable coin. I can't see it. I can't see that actually happening.
But Jeremy, maybe final thoughts on stable coins and then we can move on.
Yeah, final thoughts here. I'm going to ask the question everybody's wondering. And that's, Graham, did you possibly spend the afternoon golfing today? Because that looks like a golf shirt, man.
I was filming. I got a nice shirt at H&M. Nice. It's a first time wearing this shirt. I like it.
As soon as I saw you, I got the vibes. I was like, oh, Graham must have just got off the golf course and he's hopping on millennial money now. I don't have any thoughts on the stable coin thing. It still freaks me out.
Are you still buying the Voyager coin?
VGX. Yes, unfortunately. Let me look what that's even at. Oh, gosh. I'm getting so killed on that. It's unbelievable. That might end up being my worst investment of my life. Let me see. VGX coin. As far as percentage, it's down more than anything I think I ever bought. And that includes GoPro from back in 2017, man. But let me check out VGX. Ah, VGX is $1.61.
Oh my gosh. How much? What's your total loss?
Oh, I would have to log into the Voyager to see that. I've tried not to look recently because it's too bad, man.
That's like me and Omi. That's like, yeah.
Oh, is that okay? Well, what's going on with that situation?
Are you still holding on to that?
I still held on to it. Yeah.
Wow.
I do think long term it can do good, but yeah.
Oh, you guys probably.
Yeah.
Also, Dink coin just keeps going down too.
63,000. If I sold that today, that would be my biggest loss I've ever taken on anything in my life by a lot too.
Wow.
$63,000.
Well, Jeremy, why don't you hold on to it end of the year and then sell it for a tax loss?
Yeah, I could. No, my plan has always been with that, no matter what happened with it, is to hold it super long term in hopes that Voyager becomes this big thing and the VGX token is this big core to its rewards program and things like that. So it doesn't matter if that's at $1 or $4 or $6 or whatever. I've always planned to just hold that for years and years in the future.
But you could still hold it and take the tax loss. Why wouldn't you just do that?
Well,
sell it and then buy it back in. It's going to be lower when you buy it back in anyway.
Yeah, probably. That's Jeremy, the truth.
Pro tip. Sell all of your biggest losers and tax loss harvest for the next 3,000 years.
Well, what I'm trying to figure out is with stocks, you have like that window there and you don't have any sort of window in crypto. Like you could buy it literally one day later.
Oh, you mean the PDT rule?
Yeah.
Voyager, is that the cryptocurrency or the stock?
I'm talking about the cryptocurrency.
There's no wash sale on that.
So technically,
you could sell it and then buy it right back. There's nothing that says you can't do that. That's what I'm saying. You may as well take the tax loss. And then I guarantee there's something else that you're paying profit on. So you may as well just offset that.
Probably not.
Lower your cost basis. Get it now.
Yeah.
Right? That makes sense.
I like that. I like that a lot, Graham. I might as well. But then again, it's crypto. Who knows? It could be up by the end of this year. You never really know. It goes from a 57% loss to 57%.
Wait a minute. Yeah. This is actually really interesting. I did not know this about the crypto wash sale. Is this true?
True. You could look it up. Obviously, I'm sure the IRS could challenge anything that they want to, but that's true with anything. But yeah, because it's a currency, it's not subject to the rules of a wash sale.
And is that true about gold too?
Couldn't gold be a don't they call it a commodity? So, but yes, it's just strictly cryptocurrency. I mean, it's a currency. So unless they could prove it's a security, which they're not going to be able to.
No,
it doesn't apply. And from all I spent like a full day doing research on this, and appears you could
says wash rule typically applies to securities, but the IRS treats this as property. So
yeah,
interesting.
Well, in that case, I would recommend every time you have a loss, not financial advice. Don't sue me, bro. I would literally recommend every time I had a loss, pretty much selling and rebuying, as long as you weren't paying insane fees.
That also might be the fastest way to get audited.
Not necessarily. It's not for an audit. The hard part would be tracking your buy-in and your expenses, because even when you sell crypto, I mean, sometimes you'll see it like selling off at like a different price all the way up. It's complicated. There are sites that you could use. I think it's called Coin Tracker that you could log in and you pay for a service that will track your cost basis of every single time you purchase. You link it to like a Coinbase and they will do all of that for you. Actually, I like their site a lot. I signed up for Coin Tracker a few months ago. I do like it. They just email you like a daily update. Like, here's how much your portfolio is up. Here's how much it's down. Here is your tax loss harvest opportunity. It's a good site. I do like it. Lately, I have not liked seeing their email because it means I'm down. But it's a good site that I've liked so far.
It's interesting. Thanks for that. All right. So next topic. Going to court tomorrow, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yes.
Kevin, so far, Graham. Yeah. Graham, you sound interested in coming. Andre and Jeremy, I think you're up.
Well, I think it could be fun. How long is it?
My guess is less than 30 minutes.
Oh, yeah. That'd be awesome.
If I show up for that, what are you willing to do for me, Kevin?
Tattoo chef? I'll come over to your house, Jeremy. I'll take care of you.
You want to eat some tattoo chef with me or what?
Oh, I want to eat something.
Wait a minute. This went away. I didn't want. I just wanted you to buy the dang TTCF stock, man.
Oh, okay.
No, so what's going on, Kevin? You're not allowed to use your name anymore, or what's going on with this situation? A lot of people are like, what's going on, man?
Yeah, so long and short of it is my legal name is Kevin Paffrath. 93% of people have no idea what my last name is. Everybody knows me as Meet Kevin. On my business cards going back to 2013, I've always been Meet Kevin. And in California, there's a law that says you're allowed to have your nickname on a ballot in an election. Secretary of State told me, no, we're denying Meet Kevin. So I made a video last week asking my fans to email the Secretary of State, letting them know how they identify me as. They got like 4,000 emails in 10 minutes. So wow. Thank you to everyone for doing that. And their attorney called me real fast, really upset. and said, well, just please take the video down. We'll let you know. We'll call you by tomorrow. We'll talk about this tomorrow. Just let us talk to you about it tomorrow. Just take the video down. I'm like, okay, I'll take the video down if you promise to call me. Anyway, took the video down. They never called me, sent me a letter Saturday night at like 9:45. And they're like, you're denied. You can't use Meet Kevin. Meanwhile, there's a sumo wrestler in 2003 who was on the same exact ballot that I'm going for, who gets his sumo name on the ballot, but I can't use Meet Kevin. And so obviously in an election where every vote counts, it's very important that my identity is on there. So we're suing the state of California for that. And I am inviting y'all. My attorneys mentioned it'd be a great idea if y'all would love to come. I think that'd be wonderful. Mm-hmm. And so that way, if the judge wanted to ask, like, hey, can you educate me a little bit more on how this YouTube thing works? Y'all could be there and speak on that behalf. For example, and then I'll stop talking. Graham made a video with Macy. It's just one quick example where he goes, oh, we're going to react to Kevin on it was the reaction to the CNBC Millennial Money.
Yep.
And you say, and now we're going to react to Meet Kevin and his wife, Lauren. And it was like just a perfect evidence of like, everybody knows me as Meet Kevin and Lauren is Lauren. Right. So anyway, that's the long and short of it. And of course you're all invited to help support the cause.
That'd be awesome.
You know what? It's too bad you can't invite all of your subscribers to join, like mass send out a link and have like tens of thousands of people all joining.
So Kevin, let me ask you, do you think that it's a byproduct of just unfortunate circumstance, like you just got some bad, policymaker, or are they really clued into who you are? They know who you are, like, oh, this guy, Kevin, no, let's make his life miserable.
It's a really good question. So, like, before getting into this, I've been very anti-conspiracy anything. Usually, if there was a bar of how much conspiracy I am, I'm usually at, like, the 1% level, right? But now, getting into politics, some of the things just start smelling really fishy, right? Like, just as an example, Twitter donates hundreds of thousands of dollars. Big tech, lots of big tech. I've got to double check on Twitter, but lots of big tech is donating, in fact, millions of dollars to Gavin Newsom's campaign. I think Facebook's like 27 million, YouTube's donated to him, right? They've donated to Gavin Newsom. And now Twitter's saying, oh, we don't do Twitter verifications for recall elections, but we do them for all other elections, right? And so part of you is like, it's very odd how some of the things go together, but that's just one example. Mm-hmm. So going to this, the state of California, the Democratic Party is like, oh, we don't want any Democrat challenging the governor. This is a Republican recall. And I don't really consider myself a Democrat or a Republican. I consider myself somebody who's like right in the middle, like, look, let's just deal with homelessness, crime, and schools and traffic, because these are issues like everybody cares about, or how about the water crisis, right? These are things we should care about. This is very middle Californian issues, I say. But because I've been a registered Democrat since 18 and I'm running under that party, I wouldn't be surprised if the Democratic Party, somebody just walks through the Secretary of State's office, hey, let's punish this guy. It's just shady, because why do other people get their nicknames, but I don't?
Wait, and do you think it's specifically because you're rocking the boat as a Democrat? Like, it's like, no, you're kind of ruining our chances. We already got the Democrat that we like. Or is it specifically because Gavin Newsom's like, no, this guy. I hate this guy.
Probably both. Okay. Is it, and that's conspiratorial. But when I say probably both, I should say, like, if there were a conspiracy, which I think there's like 30 to 40% chance is kind of where I put it, is that there's some like conspiratorial stuff going on. The other 60% is me thinking like maybe these state workers are just overwhelmed. They don't like some dude questioning their authority, you know, and it's just the typical like bureaucratic, like respect my authority, you know, like that. I think that's like a 60% chance. But yeah, I mean, if you went the 30-40% conspiracy side, yeah, I mean, it would make sense. It would make, because what happens is, because I'm running, I'm diluting all of their branding, which is this is a Republican recall. It destroys that entire argument.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yes.
Kevin, what are the chances you could have like a debate with this Newsom gentleman?
Next to zero that anyone is going to get a debate with him. See, he's not compelled to do any kind of debate because he's technically not a candidate. He's running against a recall, which right. which is basically a faceless measure on a ballot, right? So I don't think anybody's going to get to debate him.
He's like grandfathered in.
Yeah.
It's not fair.
It isn't. No, it really isn't. Yeah.
Jeez.
Dang, man.
That's the world of politics. So anyway, yeah, it'll be interesting. We'll know. And quite frankly, it'll be a big moment, I think, for all of YouTube because that would set a big precedent. This would be the biggest nickname case, especially if we won, right? It'd be the biggest nickname case for social media. In really politics and name ID ever.
That would be so historical. That would be so cool.
How much is the lawsuit? How much are you in?
I have no idea yet.
Really?
We'll see. The good news is it's going to be in the tens of thousands of dollars. The good news is it's fast. Because this is an emergency hearing we're requesting, it's impossible for it to accrue the kind of hours that like normal lawsuits would because we started working on this on Sunday and we have a hearing tomorrow at 3 p.m. So like physically there's this beautiful magical limitation because this has to get decided by 5 p.m. tomorrow. So there will be a ruling tomorrow.
So that's the deadline is 5 p.m. tomorrow for the name on the ballot.
Right. And then the judge either compels the Secretary of State to go put me, Kevin, on there. And then the final list goes out at 5 p.m. Or the judge says, I don't know YouTube. Sorry. Now, the person we got, the judge we have is a 50-year-old, which is probably, I mean, like, I don't want to come across as like ageist ever. But like, if we had a 70 or 80-year-old judge, I think that'd be really bad for YouTube. Because just the demographic of people watching YouTube are not 70 or 80. So I think while 50 is still probably a little bit on the higher side, I think there's a lot. I think they're probably more involved than YouTube. So maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. You know, man, this is crazy how fast everything has to happen in this situation, how fast, you know, this has to be decided and it has to be decided tomorrow and there's no like real time. And then, you know, I worry like, you know, I hope the judge, you know, calls it fair and square, you know, what they truly believe. Because what if, you know, This is where we get into the weird stuff with politics. What if the judge is like a super Gavin Newsom fan? You know, you never really know. Like,
Kevin, how does that work with the conflict of interest? How do they ensure the judge doesn't have any prior, you know, dealings or biases?
Well, unfortunately, the way that probably would play out is if we lost, we appealed, and then an appeal court determined that. That's my guess.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that. What do you think? I think, Andre, you were going to say something.
Yeah, no, I was just going to ask you, how did you get such a fast emergency hearing? Like, how does that work? Because I always hear people like, oh, I'm going through a lawsuit, but it's going to take 2 years before I hear an answer. Like, how does that work?
I've been there. So there are a few things. One, like, you can usually in many lawsuits get temporary restraining order hearings very quickly. So those could be like injunction hearings. Usually you get those within 21 days. Now, oftentimes what parties decide to do is they decide to come up with some kind of temporary agreement. And then the lawsuit goes on for like 2 years, right, before it gets settled. This case is different because it's a lawsuit under election law. And election law says any election matters go instantly to the top of the list.
Got it. That makes sense. That makes sense. Are they more expensive typically than like an average non-election lawsuit, or it's not a cost thing?
I would say it's probably less expensive because you're really, what you're trying to do is put together your research, your case. It's you versus really, I mean, the Secretary of State's attorneys are going to be there arguing their case, but it's really, it's you presenting your oral arguments. The other side presents their oral arguments, and the judge, I envision it, and I haven't gone through it yet, but I envision it much more like a Judge Judy, where it's like, you present your case. Judge Judy goes, well, what about this? Well, what about this? Or what about this? And then, I don't know, this is how I'm ruling, you know, and that's done. Right. That's my guess.
Who's the wrestler?
I'm sorry.
Who's the wrestler? You said the wrestler was running as a Republican or a Democrat.
Okay. So you mean the sumo wrestler?
Yes.
The sumo wrestler. I'll show you. And this is probably the best precedent that we really have is right here. So this is the official recall ballot from 2003. Okay. And if I go down here, I get this person, Kurt Takikazi Reitmeier. And when you Google Takikazi sumo wrestler, there's an LA Times article that comes up, and it says Takikazi is just his stage name or his sumo name. And I'm pretty sure I can get it pretty quickly. It's a sumo name that that means like the strike of the wind or something like that. So it's like he got to use it.
Sorry, I think I said that's a Georgian name, like Russian Georgian. But
what's that?
I think that's a Georgian name.
A Georgian name?
Georgian, yeah. Oh. Takikazi, yeah.
Yeah, here. This is the LA Times article. Reitmeier, whose sumo name, Takikazi, means wind from a sword stroke.
Hmm.
But so anyway, like, he got his name. Where's my fairness?
What was their argument for him?
He didn't have an argument. He put it on and got it.
Wow.
So you think it's just you they're targeting? And okay.
That's what it feels like.
Mm. Yeah.
Because see, other people are suing as well right now. I mean, there are other issues. But here's the thing. There's this guy, Larry Elder, who's suing the state of California. And he's suing because he didn't even qualify for the ballot because apparently there was some issue with his tax returns, like the redactions were done wrong or something like that. And so he's suing for not being on the ballot, but he's suing because he made a mistake. And he's saying like, hey, just because we made a mistake, that's not fair. Like, let us on anyway. Then you've got another person who's suing the former mayor of San Diego, who wants his thing to say former mayor of San Diego. But they're like, well, that's not your current job. You can't use what you used to be as your listed profession.
But so what if he identifies as that?
What's that?
What if he identifies as that, though?
Well, it's a professional designation is the problem. So like the rules, like I could say, what if I identify as Meet Kevin, right? Which I think I might say tomorrow. But so you've got these two other candidates who are making this argument for really what almost seems like special treatment. I'm just looking for equal treatment. So we'll see.
Yeah, and the thing that's ridiculous about this is they could have done like 3 minutes of research on you and been like, oh yeah, this guy's legit called me Kevin. You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, you want to go as like, let's say I was running for something political and I want to go as Jeremy the Sledgehammer Lefebvre. And they're like, we can't find anything about you being a sledgehammer. You just want to call a nickname.
Right, but that's why I'm more inclined to believe the 30% quote unquote conspiracy part of it, because it just seems like it's like, ah, oh, this YouTuber annoying kid, like just get him off the ballot, I don't care.
Yeah, that's exactly kind of what it feels like, and it's unfortunate, but I'll tell you, it's just there have been so many things so far that just make me go, wow, this is how the game's played, and it's just a lot of it's like it just gets more dirty when you start opening your eyes to it, and it's like, oh,
can you share? Can you share what some of those things might be? Is it something? Yeah.
I mean,
the spying.
Meantime, stuff, let's see what happens tomorrow.
Okay. Sorry, I was going to say the not the spying, but like you had people drive by your house. Does that still happen?
That not so much anymore, which is good. You know, I don't know if it was just an initial thing or whatever, but that not so much anymore, thankfully. Good.
Hey, Andre, I saw a good question posted in our member chat here. I think it's a question for you. It says, question, I thought crypto was a hedge against the USD printing. So if the government makes a coin that is tied to the dollar, then why use it?
That's a great point. That's a great question. So the reason is because if the government's printing their stable coin and we're using it to pump the crypto market, I mean, it's just going to continue going up with the stable coins printing. So as long as you're invested in it, you're kind of riding that wave. But that's a good question. That's a good point. So if the government starts printing an infinite amount of these, right, and starts putting it into Bitcoin, I mean, what would happen? Bitcoin's price would go up. So as long as you're invested in it, I mean, you stand to benefit from it.
Yeah. And Kevin, if you don't mind expanding on something, you brought up this earlier around the banks, the big banks, potentially being interested in getting their hands on stable coins. If I recall, it was you that brought that up. Like, why would the banks want to get their hands on stable coins? Would this be something that's kind of a game changer for their business models and make them much more profitable, at least in the short term, and then create a wreck? Like, what's the incentive for them to even be involved with stable coins?
Yeah, so the best example I have right now is JP Morgan. They have something known as the JPM coin, and it's built on the Ethereum network. And they use it for transfers between them and other banks. So they've made an agreement with other banks that, hey, like if we need to send you money, rather than us sending you money in dollars, let's just send you JPM coins, which are worth $1. And we'll be able to send that back and forth instantaneously without having to go through intermediaries like the Fed through wire transfers. So they're actually using it as a way to represent potentially hundreds of millions of dollars. And so they're doing probably the largest scale tests of these stable coins. I believe the Federal Reserve will probably end up partnering with big banks like JPM to inherit essentially their experiences.
That's a good point. Yeah. So it's faster, it's cheaper, it's more efficient, more transparent for them, which is what they love. And
it's just a representation, really, is really what it is, right? It's a representation of the dollar, and it's so much easier to just transact on the blockchain.
Well, in this case, it's like, I mean, the current system, we're trading sort of derivatives, like kind of promises, which is why they take several days to settle. We need these intermediaries. We need these people and these companies to verify, like, did this person have money? Did they send it to the correct place? But with this, it's kind of like truly digital, right? In the sense that, like, it's instant and you're actually transferring money and not promises of money. And that's kind of what it's solving is actual money, actual money.
Yeah. Depending on how you look at it. So, but I'm still trying to understand why would, let's say, JP Morgan benefit? Are they going to make a bunch more money because they're doing this? Or is it just kind of like something that helps their customers? So it helps them.
You know, so Jeremy, are you asking in terms of like how it is today or with the Fed?
I'm asking more in terms of, you know, JP Morgan creating this JPM coin. Is this anything that's going to help their business model in terms of, is this going to help them bring in more revenue, profits, anything like that? Or is this just, you know, like a side?
I think it's too early for that. You know, I imagine whatever marginal cost savings they'll get out of this, it will just be offset by research fees and labor costs and actually putting it all together. So I don't think the intention right now is profit, but now it's more research-based. I think in the long term, though, oh, yeah, if you know, they figure out this coin model, I think it's going to be huge for banking, and efficiency will just go skyrocketing.
Not only banking, but crypto in general, because the more on and off ramps you create, you know, if like you imagine Bitcoin as like a central hub and you have different bridges from different points, you're increasing that velocity and the amount of entrances, I guess, from different points. And so banks will integrate crypto at some point, like custody of accounts of Bitcoin, you know, of Ethereum or whatever it might be. But as far as how they benefit today, as far as their business model, this is like the more 30% conspiracy part, where it's like, you know, part of the shadow banking system, where it's like they can kind of fly under the radar of the Federal Reserve, where they can, you know, the children can do things dubiously without dad knowing about it. But that's, you know, I'm not saying that's what will happen, but that's what the Fed fears might happen if they start integrating that stuff before they regulate it.
Yeah, Graham, have you ever thought about buying some of these big banks like JP Morgan, just dollar cost averaging and something like that, or Goldman Sachs, like one of the really well-run ones? And I'm not talking about Wells Fargo and stuff.
JPM? I think I have like 70, 80 grand in JP Morgan stock. I have not bought. I stopped buying a while ago. It was right after COVID. So yeah, it would be around $100. Was where I stopped buying. I bought the bulk of it probably in like the high 80s to low 90s. Stopped when it hit 100. It's tempting. I really like them. And I have to say, I'm a huge fan of their bank. I like their loans. I like their service. There's a lot to them that I really enjoy. I think they're a really good company. I like their CEO. I think he has some really good insights in the market. And I would consider buying more.
Wow. Okay. And you know, what's the difference for those that are interested? What's the difference between being a private client at Chase and a private bank at Chase? What do you need to get in those different things?
Totally different banks. So the JP Morgan private bank is completely separate from Chase. It's like within the same house, but it's like, they're over here, the other people over here, you know, there's not a lot of communication between the two. The JP Morgan private bank just gives you a person that you could call up at any point for any issues. Like, imagine Bank of America. You want to get a hold of someone at Bank of America, good luck. You can't do it. You have to physically go in a branch, stand in line, try to talk to somebody. And even then, it's sometimes 50-50. I've had so many times where they tell you, oh, you know, you actually have to talk to this person, but they're out at lunch right now. We have this other branch that you could go to. But with JP Morgan, you have a team of people that you could call for anything you need to, or you just email them and they get back to you immediately and they just help you out. It's like talking with a friend. Hey, man, this issue. You know what? It reminds me kind of like the customer service for American Express, where I guess for the platinum cards kind of got downhill, but it used to be where you'd be able to call them up. Within 30 seconds, you'd have a representative on the phone who was doing anything to help you out. Imagine that, but with a bank with no fees.
How many subscribers do you need to have a Chase private bank?
At least 10 million subscribers. No, I'm kidding. it depends. I got in through a relationship with the Oppenheim Group, and that's how I was able to get in like 4 years ago.
But what are the actual requirements?
Technically, it's $10 million of investable assets, but I've heard they've lowered it down on a case-by-case basis to $5 million.
Oh, wow.
Well, now, why did you want to get in? Is it just for that customer service, or were there any other benefits that you saw?
Mortgages.
Or your mortgages. Okay. Oh,
the mortgages are incredible. I got two mortgages through the JP Morgan Private Bank. I've never had an easier experience. The entire process was 20 minutes over the phone, and they got me a loan at the lowest interest rate.
Well, let me just zoom out for a second and say, this is like, you know how people complain like, oh, the rich people have it so easy. It's so much easier. It's like, it's the people who get the loans are the people who need it the least.
Well, that's how loans work, though. You want to loan your money to where it's as safe as possible. And when you have someone with a high income, with a good credit score, with plenty of collateral, you are the safest borrower. So it makes sense that those are the people who they're more likely to lend money to.
I'm just pointing out the irony of it. It's just,
I know. But it didn't. But here's the thing. It's like you have to go through that ringer. Like when I was 21, no bank wanted to give me a loan. So I think it's something that anyone could build up to. It just, it takes time. You got to get, you know, you got to go up the totem pole on this. And so you got to get jerked around a little bit. And then, not like that, Jeremy.
That's
like
for that. Kevin to do to Jeremy later.
Yeah. Your hand movements. Okay. Your hand movements. Kevin, what's your favorite bank? You like JPM the best of the bunch?
It's fine. Yeah, they're okay. Look, to just me, okay? What Graham said is right on. It's, I think people like to hate the player when they should be hating the game. It's very easy to bag on, you know, wealthier people. Oh, they get all these special privileges. Just like it's very easy to complain that, oh, Amazon pays no taxes, right? Like we hear that. But then when you actually look at, like, when you peel back the layers, it's like, ah, well, wait a minute. Those people who started or might be wealthy now, they started with that $500 credit limit on Target just like you, or they started with that secured card. Now, sure, there's maybe 20% of people who whatever who inherited their wealth, but most millionaires are self-made. Certainly more than, I would say, two-thirds are self-made. And so when you look at it that way, it's like, well, look, here's what the game is. If you want to play it, go play it. And there are plenty of people, there are plenty of YouTube videos who tell you exactly how to play the game. But what bothers me is when people are like, oh, well, I just can't get involved in real estate because I don't have a JPM lender, that a mortgage banker I could just call up. Well, then get off your butt and call five or six different lenders and find somebody who is willing to work with you and is hungry to work with you and make a deal happen. When I first got my loan, when I first went to qualify for a home, I called six or seven different lenders. I got denied by all but one. And guess what happened the next 6 years? All the other properties I bought, I went back to that one person who gave me the opportunity. And all the other people are like, Kevin, oh, now you're doing all this real estate. I want to be your lender. I'm like, remember that one time you told me no? Yeah.
Wow.
That's why I don't buy a Blue Heron house. I got a long story, but I don't want to get into that.
No, I got to hear this. Wait, what?
All right, Andre. So there's a luxury home builder here in Vegas, yeah, Blue Heron.
Yeah.
Very well known if you got a lot of money and you want a custom house, essentially. Well, this is when I was starting my real estate marketing company. I was trying to just do some photos of a pretty property so I could have, like, you know, stuff I could show potential clients, right? Send them in emails and stuff like that. Well, I had this thing. They were supposed to allow me to one of their model homes to take pictures, you know, drone pictures, just random pictures and stuff. And last minute, they asked me, you know, for a bunch of my work. And here I was just going to take photos, like, you know, and I had to show them what I had, but I had very little work at that time because I'm trying to, like, build up so I get work. And then last minute, they're like, no, you don't have enough work, so we're not going to allow you to take pictures of our model home. And I was just, that was, like, devastating to me because it was already, like, agreed upon that I was going to do this. And then last minute, somebody else butted in. And all for me to just take some dang photos of that model home. And it left a sour taste in my mouth. And I have no interest in ever buying a home from them. So.
Wow. Did you guys actually know that Tom from MySpace, the guy who created MySpace, is actually one of the biggest investors in Blue Heron?
I don't like him either, then. That's why MySpace went down, and that's why I'm buying more Facebook stock.
That's awesome.
Until I found out they were giving money to Gavin Newsom, so now I need to sell
that. I stopped.
I just can't like anybody now.
Wait, you're still invested in Facebook?
Though. I know I am.
Traitor?
I know. I'm sorry, Kevin, man. I apologize. I just like money, man. I like money more than politics. What can I say?
Into politics.
Hey, Kevin, with now you getting in politics and you knowing about, you know, some of these big tech companies maybe funding Mr. Newsom here, does this ever change your perspective in the future on buying those certain stocks if they were to sell off?
You know, I think that's more of like a that's a really tough one to answer. I don't know if, you know, a company's political lobbying, which is really just them trying to do the best for their company, right? I don't know if that is a factor in how we invest or whether it should be. Now, if a company's doing something unethical, then maybe that is, right? But, you know, okay, because they're donating to Newsom, who's my competitor, am I now, that's it, now I'm shorting Facebook. I think that would be emotional.
That's a good point, Kevin. And that brings me to even a bigger point I would love to ask you guys, because I don't know if you've ever thought about this before, but are there certain companies you wouldn't invest in because maybe you feel they're bad in terms, let's like a tobacco company. Would you ever invest in a tobacco company? Or is that like, I couldn't touch that because I'm against smoking? What about a casino company? Well, there's some people that get addicted to casinos. What about an alcohol company? What's your take on that?
I don't see a problem. Well, first of all, I think, look, if people are worried about like mental health issues related to either substance or drug or gambling abuse, then we should be having a conversation about solving our mental health crisis, not about telling people what to do. Like, I'm a big fan of let people gamble. Let people drink alcohol, you know, whatever. Like if somebody's worried about DUIs, then enforce DUIs. If you're worried about mental health problems, then solve mental health problems. But telling people what to do, I'm not a big fan of. But as far as being an investor, I typically find myself just investing in things that I really understand really well. Anytime I invest in something I don't understand well, I get really panicky way too quickly. And like, it's like my emotions get amplified because I just don't know enough. Like when somebody talks crap about Tesla, I don't care. I feel like I know the company so well, I can argue it till I'm blue in the face, not worried about it. But if I go into a company like I really want to invest in cybersecurity, but I know so little about it. So how am I supposed to defend the company when I don't know cybersecurity that well, right? That's not to say it's not a good industry. That's not to say it's the right long run play. It's just, I just don't know enough. So like, maybe if I was like a Kathy Wood and I had a team of 10 people and one of the people was like, Kevin, I've worked in cybersecurity for 10 years. Here's what you got to know. This is what you got to look for. Well, gosh, I feel a lot more comfortable. I don't have that, A. And B, I certainly don't have that for tobacco companies.
Yeah. And Kevin, that's a great point. I mean, you probably know about as much about cybersecurity as you do about frozen food. What about you, Andre and Graham? I would love to hear from you guys on this perspective. Would you ever not invest in a company because any of those things we talked about before?
Yeah. Like the question of ethical investing is something I got so much crap for when I used to show my dividend portfolio. And I was like, oh, I have a ton of Philip Morris and you know, Altria and gosh, what else did I have? I had a ton of stuff that was, I guess,
dividends. Yeah.
Yeah. And the sin stocks, I suppose you can call them. And it's funny because it's such a personal issue that like everybody's ethics and morals, it's like, where do you draw your personal line in the sand? And I think everybody wants to make it very objective. Like you should objectively never invest in sin stocks or this or that or the other. And my argument is the moment that anybody tries to get objective with it, like factually, like this is wrong. And I'm like, wait a minute, hold on. If that's where you're going to draw your line in the sand, let me just back up a foot and let me just say, where do you live? Oh, you live in the U.S. Oh, you're a first world country person. Oh, interesting. Oh, you think that you're innocent. Oh, you think that because you don't own Philip Morris that you're not actually like pillaging the world. Oh, that's cute. It's such an ignorant perspective to me when people try to speak about it so objectively, especially coming from a first world nation, that it's like, you have no idea the amount of involvement we're all connected. Even somebody who's, let's say, a company that's so beloved, like let's say Apple, you guys think they have no business ties with suppliers or people that are involved in like massive amounts of pollution and, you know, questionable amounts of integrity? Like, come on, just grow up. I don't know where to draw that objective box and box you in and say like, this is wrong. Otherwise, I think it's a very subjective issue. That's just my perspective.
That's a great point. Yeah, Andre said it perfectly. When it comes to myself, I usually really only invest in companies that I like and use. I think it's fun to go to the Wynn and Encore every now and then. And well, as long as I win, as long as I'm up. So I mean, I have no problem investing in those companies. So I think usually I'll invest in companies that I like and use. But otherwise, I tend to look at it objectively. And like Andre said, we each have a different idea of what's acceptable and what's not. And so I usually try not to concern myself with that.
The stock I got it on was Facebook. You know, when I was invested in Facebook or anytime I talk about that, I always will see comments, oh, Facebook's the devil. They don't support, you know, or they don't allow free speech and all this stuff. And it's just like, you know. Oh, gosh, man. But yeah, there's always those certain, you know, companies that get a lot of that stuff, right? But anyways, it's an interesting subject, and it's one, you know, I think people think
about. I will say that one thing I have objectively, I guess, evolved on morally is prison stocks. I really don't feel good about this one.
I agree. Even
their dividends are off the charts, and I'm just like, I can't do it. I don't think prison systems should ever be monetized. It doesn't make sense to me.
I'm with you, Andre. The private prison system, that's so sketch, and it's just a bad business model. It's like, it's the most, that's the one. I'm with you. I can't ever touch that.
Like, objectively, I'm just like, I'm done with it.
Yeah, and I will say smoking is a hard one for me to touch, because I don't know if this is true, but I've heard of these companies pushing out in other countries, you know, more third world countries, like pushing cigs to even like kids and stuff, right?
Right.
And that's the type of stuff I'm like, oh gosh, you know, you could never get away with that, obviously, in the United States. But, you know, over there where there's not regulations and you all of a sudden have a supplier giving this stuff to kids, I'm like, that's a hard one for me as well.
Yeah. But then you get into the issue of like, well, do other companies employ child labor? Like, does Apple do it in China? Like, where do you draw that line? I don't know.
True. It's true. Yeah. Nike used to get that all the time back in the day. I remember they might still be getting it, but I remember back in the day they used to get that all the time.
Right.
So, Kevin, how are you going to fix all California's problems?
There's so much. It's one of the reasons I've such a detailed plan on my website at meetkevin.com. Because to me, you can't fix one thing without trying to fix other things. Like, you can't fix homeless on our streets without fixing education. And you can't fix poverty without fixing education and crime and enforcement, and which laws should we be enforcing more, and why are we turning a blind eye to so many men, others, right? Like, stop me if I mentioned this last week. Did I just talk about the fire hydrants last week?
Yes.
Okay. You remember that. I won't bring it up again. Basically, people are stealing water from fire hydrants, so rather than deal with the crime, they're removing fire hydrants, right? And like, it's the same logic as in San Francisco. There's so many people stealing from like Neiman Marcus or Walgreens that they're just closing the stores early. Well, like, how about enforce the crime, right? Or how about more police? Or how, you know, like, the way California goes about solving its problems are just illogical. But there's so much illogicness, and I think just made that word up. That it's going to take some serious work. And so what I just keep saying is, I don't know of anybody who's going to work harder than me at fixing that.
This is true.
You know what? It reminds me of remodeling a house, where it's like, you can't just remodel the kitchen and then leave the bathroom all outdated. You can't just leave the master bedroom then completely unfinished. It's like, it's one thing to another. If you want to do one thing, you may as well do this. And then if you're doing that, well, you may as well start over.
This is triggering me.
Tear down the house.
This is leading right to Andre and his rental property situation.
What? Not my rental property.
Or your flip. I was thinking about
my house. No, I'm not even in that deal just yet, but I'm talking about my house. Okay, I think I said it last week, but just please don't ever buy an appliance that anybody claims is new or like new or floor model ever. Just don't do it. I bought that $8,000 fridge, and I think I've sunk like $1,500 into it to try to repair it. And we repaired it, but apparently the Freon in the fridges, I guess that there's some kind of a micro leak, and they have to like basically take apart the whole fridge just to isolate where that leak is. And I'm just kind of like an investing, you know, how a stock just destroys you. And you're like, well, I'm down this much. I'm just going to write it to zero. I'm not going to sell this. I know a lot of us sometimes think that way, but like, it's like the sunk cost fallacy. I just called it and I'm like, you know what? I'm done with this fridge. I'm going to cut my losses. I'll sell it for whatever, $5,000 if I have to, let somebody else repair it, buy a brand new one, and just lesson learned.
Wow, that's insane, Andre. I mean, I would have had questions when, you know, $8,000, it sounds so cheap for a refrigerator. Like, you know, like,
well, it was nine and a half new. It was nine and a half new. So it's not that far away from, you know, like new.
I was kidding, by the way. But yeah,
Jeremy's the kind of guy that's like, what, Apple Pen?
that's insane that you had issues spending that much, because, you know, most fridges are what, $2,000, $3,000, maybe $4,000, And to spend that much, you would expect, you know, that baby to be working perfect. So
the dude who spent $30,000.
if you don't mind, before we end, I want to ask y'all about the Robinhood IPO. I'd love to start with Graham on this.
Yeah. I'd be really listen, I'm not going to buy in immediately. I have no qualms about investing in Robinhood. I think they've cornered the market. They have an interface that is undeniably probably one of the easiest things to look at. And I want to wait for the dust to settle, because I feel like there's so much emotion surrounding it. Like, people are really just like, oh, I'm gonna short them. Could we short them on Robinhood? And it's like, well, kind of defeats the purpose, but all righty then. Seriously, it's like the questions like that makes no sense to me. So I think it's probably going to take a few months for things to settle. After a few months, I'll certainly evaluate. I have no problems investing in Robinhood, and I want to see where they land. I want to see where the chips fall, and then I can make a decision.
Like, for me, I feel like it's one of those situations where like personally, I've learned my lesson with IPOs, never to invest on day one. But on the same side, I feel like our world, our perspective on the internet is like, oh, Robinhood, like nobody likes them. But that's like 10% of the actual people who might be representing the actual, I don't know, their user base. So I would not be surprised if like day one, they take off like a rocket and we're just like, great.
Yep. That's literally how it happens. It's like you get burned on one IPO because it falls after you buy it. And then the very next IPO, you're like, I'm not touching IPOs. It just goes to the moon.
I can see that.
I think they're underpricing. I'm going to be transparent about that. I think they're underpricing. They're trying to go for $38 to $40. I think it's going to be worth way more than that. Their last EPS annualized puts them at about a dollar of PE ratio per share price. So if they end up trading for $100, that would be an annualized 2021 price to earnings ratio of 100, which for Robinhood doesn't even sound that ridiculous. In 2021 PE ratio terms. So now, are their numbers going to stay as strong as Q1? Probably not, because you had Dogecoin, and you had a lot more activity then. But then again, you look at Interactive Brokers today. Interactive Brokers killed it. Like they beat revenue, they beat users, they beat on everything. It was really good, and so that bodes well, I think, for Robinhood. I think at $38 to $42, that's like they're saying their annualized PE for 2021 should be $38 to $42 or whatever. Bargain, man.
So, as far as my thoughts, first off, I'm reading on my favorite app. It's called The Hungry Bowl. And I was just reading on The Hungry Bowl right now that it says, according to SEC filings released today, Robinhood is hoping to receive a market valuation of $35 billion ahead of its public offering. So here's my thoughts about Robinhood. The issue is they're going public right after they had this incredibly hot year with insane numbers, right? Everybody has to spend time at home. Everybody was getting in the stock market. Well, I don't want to say everybody, but a ton of people. The amount of new investors into the market has gone down dramatically over the past few months, right? You had this huge ramp up. And so now, where are the user growth numbers going to come from Robinhood? I think it's going to slow substantially. And if you have a pretty decently high valuation and then your new users slow substantially because all of a sudden the crypto market's falling, right? Which is something that's slightly benefited them, but really the stocks, just stocks has benefited them so much. And to Kevin's point about like somebody like Interactive Brokers, right? Well, a company like that, they benefit from people graduating, right? Like essentially you might start out on a Robinhood, a Webull, something like that, right? And then as you get in the market more, you move on and you get to somebody like a TD Ameritrade, a Fidelity Investments, or an Interactive Brokers. And so Robinhood, I think, is in a tough position where they're going to have these ridiculous year-over-year comps to comp against. And I think they should have probably waited a year before they went public so they could show more realistic numbers. But I think they can raise more money this way. But I think it's going to hurt their stock price over the next year or two, if that makes any sense. You kind of want to go public when you're hot because you can raise more money. But then it makes it harder for your stock to perform any, in any good manner for, you know, any time after that IPO, essentially. So, yeah, I'm not interested personally in it, but I'll be watching. That's for sure.
Nice. Take us away, Graham.
Did you give your opinion, Andre?
Yeah. I did. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Cool.
Then all take right, us guys. Away, Graham.
So subscribe really quick before you leave, click the little subscribe button. I guarantee like half the people watching this right now are not subscribed. That's got to change. It's totally free to do. It takes you a split second. And then while you're at it, you may as well hit the like button. Also make sure to add the Millennial Money Clips channel. The link is down below in the description with some other little goodies there. Thank you guys so much for watching. I really appreciate it. And until next time.
Peace.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.